Soon after joining the U.S. Supreme Court in 1970, Associate Justice Harry Blackmun received an unwelcome surprise. Chief Justice Warren Burger put him in charge of writing the majority opinion in Roe v. Wade. This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Prior to writing the opinion that, along with Doe v. Bolton, imposed the world's most liberal abortion regime on the United States, Blackmun apparently thought little about abortion, but the opinion he wrote, plus the enormous criticism of the opinion and of him personally, turned Blackmun into a strident exponent of abortion, insisting that a woman's right to choose to abort her child is a fundamental right. Sue Ellen Browder majored in journalism and ended up working for Cosmopolitan magazine, where she says she produced the propaganda that sold the sexual revolution to American women, and with it, legalized abortion. It's been many years since her Cosmo days, and Sue tells her story in her most recent book from Ignatius Press, Subverted: How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement. As to her change of heart, suffice it to say that Sue is a speaker at this year's March for Life in Washington, D.C. We are blessed that Sue, a great friend of the college, recently moved here to Lander, and in anticipation of the March for Life, I asked Sue about her research into Harry Blackmun and Roe v. Wade.
Okay, well, I was writing this book, Subverted, How I Helped the Sexual Revolution Hijack the Women's Movement, and I'd gotten to the point where I had found that a book had greatly influenced Betty Friedan, who was the who had launched the 1960s women's movement in 1963 with her book The Feminine Mystique, a book written by a NARAL founder, the National Abortion Rights Action League founder. It was titled Abortion. This book had influenced Betty. This man, along with his book, had encouraged her to insert abortion in the women's movement. I also found out that this book, it's called Abortion, the First Authoritative and Documented Report on the Laws and Practices Governing Abortion in the U.S. and Around the World, and How, for the Sake of Women Everywhere, They Can and Must Be Reformed. That subtitle alone is a masterpiece of propaganda, because the book was absolutely filled with errors. Anyway, I had found this book had influenced Betty Friedan, encouraging her to put abortion in the women's movement, and it had also been used as a foundation for the writing of Roe v. Wade. It was a masterpiece of propaganda. How did that book get into the writing of Roe v. Wade? When did Harry Blackmun, who was the author of Roe and Doe, Doe is the companion opinion of Roe v. Wade, how did he find that book, and how in the world did he end up inserting it as a foundation for the writing of Roe v. Wade? Well, I had to go to the Library of Congress to try to figure out how that happened, because the Blackmun papers are there, and Harry Blackmun has kept basically every piece of paper he ever had in his life. There were like 500,000 pieces of paper. But my little goal was to go there and find out where that book got inserted in Roe. It was cited in Roe seven times, and the legal papers of Cyril Chestnut Means, who was a NARAL attorney, are cited another seven times. So that opinion is based on the two of the pro-abortion activists of the 1960s.
Well, you said that Blackmun was less than thrilled by having the assignment to write Roe. And at least initially, it did not turn out well. Tell us about that.
Yes, he was a 61-year-old family man with three daughters. He was a conservative Republican. He'd grown up in a working-class neighborhood in St. Paul, Minnesota. And abortion wasn't something he'd even thought of. I mean, it wasn't on his radar. And so when he was given the assignment shortly after he arrived on the court, according to Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, Blackmun was the slowest writer on the court, and his craftsmanship lacked finesse. He didn't know. Basically, he was struggling with a subject he didn't understand and trying to write about it when he didn't write very well, I guess you'd say. at the same time, Chief Justice Warren Burger believed that the arguments in the Roe and Doe cases had been weak, so weak that the case was going to stand or fall on Blackmun's opinions, on the writing of Blackmun's opinions. So Blackmun was struggling with this mightily. He goes into his to the library at the university, at the Library of Congress. He works and works and works and works on this to try to get it right. And when he comes out and with his first draft, his colleagues on both the left and the right on the court slam it. They considered it very poorly written. There were a lot of criticisms of it. So Harry withdraws it and says, okay, I'm going to go out. I'm going to try again. I'm going to try to do better. And he goes out that summer to the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, where he had been a doctor's attorney for I think 6 years, 9 years, the best years of his life, he said, the best years of his professional life. And he went out to the Mayo Clinic, and while he was out there, his very liberal clerk, $15,000 a year, just a clerk from Harvard, who was an excellent writer, was back in D.C. helping Blackmun craft the opinions. And from what I can tell from the papers, it was that clerk that found that book and based Roe v. Wade on that. It's a template. You have to be a writer to understand that a piece of writing is craft. It's a craft. It's like building a chair. It's not some great inspiration. It's like building a chair. You have to have a form for it. And I was looking, so that you have to understand as a writer, the form, the invisible form, a form disappears in a piece of writing. But you've got an invisible form there that is very persuasive. And that invisible form was where came from this book, this abortion book.
Hmm. Blackmun insisted that abortion was all about women's freedom, but abortion had not, for the most part, been a feminist issue. What changed? Or perhaps nothing changed, and the story and the spin changed, but what happened?
That's a good question. And until the 1970s, most feminists opposed abortion. And it wasn't until Betty Friedan had accepted Larry Leder's arguments, again, in this book, is a very influential book that nobody's ever heard of, that once she accepted Larry Leder's arguments, she rammed abortion. And rammed is not too strong a word. She was a very powerful lady. And she was at the second annual conference of the National Organization for Women on November 18th, 1967, in the Chinese Room of the Mayflower Hotel. That is when the National Organization for Women inserted abortion rights into their political platform that night. And there were only about 100 people in that room. The abortion created an absolute uproar. They fought over it till almost midnight. And after the dust settled, what had happened is only 57 people, a mere 57 people, had voted to insert abortion in the women's movement. And at that point, one-third of these fervent feminists walked out and later resigned from now over the abortion vote. So we have in our country today this sense that all good feminists believe in abortion. This was not true from the very beginning. It's still not true today. And my claim as a journalist, as I've been investigating this now for a good 10 years, is that the pro-life women's movement is the authentic feminist movement, both of the 19th century, the 20th century, and the 21st century.
Roe, right from the get-go, was criticized as bad or at least shoddy legal reasoning, even the final draft. It was coupled with, as you point out, dubious science and dubious facts about abortion. Mm-hmm. How did Blackmun respond to that?
He paid attention. From the reports of his clerks and his secretaries, he apparently read almost every one of those thousands and thousands of letters that came pouring into the court, 75% of them negative. So he paid attention, and he was disturbed by the response. But the more he was criticized, the more he dug in his heels and thought he'd done the right thing. He never understood where this information came from. Whether he even saw this book is questionable. But because his clerk said, as he wrote this history for the Blackmun papers, he said, "I think we should not fact check this right now until after we hear oral arguments again." Now, why would you not fact check an opinion in the Supreme Court? Did they ever fact check it? If they did, the fact checking was faulty. So anyway, he listened to the criticisms, but the more he was attacked by the left and by the right and praised by the left, the more he dug in his heels and he was sure that he was right. He thought he had liberated women after all. Mm. You know, he's in his 60s. What did he know? He didn't know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and so much of Lawrence Ladder's book was based on Ladder's own fear of population control.
It was.
Or desire
yeah.
for population yeah. control.
He
fear
was
of population.
He was a population controller. He thought we were breeding ourselves to death. He even wrote a book called Breeding Ourselves to Death. He thought people were the planet... very much a population controller. He was more of a population controller even than Margaret Sanger, who he'd written her biography, and he called her the most influential person in his life. Margaret Sanger actually opposed abortion. People don't realize that. But Larry Leder, that was his idea. He was very fond of the abortion idea. He said we needed, if we're going to have contraception and to limit population, you've got to have abortion as a backup because contraception fails. He knew enough to know that contraception doesn't work that, you know, all the time. If contraception works 97% of the time and people have sex 100 times, then they're going to get pregnant. A woman's going to get pregnant 3 times. So he was right. I mean, contraception isn't 100%. And so if you want to limit population or basically kill a bunch of people so that you think you're saving the planet, then you've got to have abortion as a backup. I mean, that's what it is.
Well, of course, this isn't really on the topic, but of course, that's going on in places like Africa and South America and elsewhere for environmental reasons now. You know, we're scared of too many people and too much pollution and too much carbon dioxide. So you better import abortion and contraception as fast as possible.
That's right. I spoke at the UN at a group empowering women. And there was a woman from Kenya sitting next to me. And she was furious at how they're trying to enforce contraception and abortion, the UN, on Africa. And she sit there and she says, "We don't need your contraception and we don't need your abortion." She says, "We need clean water and electricity and we need food." So she let them have it. We were supposed to not be too politically incorrect, but she kind of was. She was wonderful.
I know you've written this article and it's out at publishers, and we'll let people on the podcast know when it comes out.
I'll let you know when we get an acceptance, probably before we...
Good. Now, you'll be one of the speakers on the National Mall for the March for Life this January 24th. In one sentence, if that's possible, what will be your message?
I think what we need to say is, if we want to get the mainstream media's attention and get this feminist story straight as pro-life women, we need to take back the F word, feminism, and shout it to the skies.
However rude it may be these days to say so, writes philosopher Jay Bujaszewski, there are some moral truths that we all really know, truths which a normal human being is unable not to know. They are a universal possession, an emblem of rational mind, an heirloom of the family of man. Close quote. One of these truths, Bujaszewski goes on to argue in his book, What We Can't Not Know, is that killing a child in the womb is a moral evil. We can pretend we don't know it, we can tell ourselves we don't know it, and we can fool ourselves for a little while. But deep down, Bujaszewski points out, we know the truth, and conscience will sooner or later take its revenge. This year, if you're near a March for Life, take the opportunity to make a stand. If you're not in a position where you can march, set aside an hour or so to pray. Pray that what we can't not know about the evil of abortion becomes clear, and that God would grant us a season of repentance and renewal. Only then will we change our laws to reflect the obvious truth about the child in the womb. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tunkowicz.